You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Hello and welcome to By the Well. I'm neither Fran Barber or Robin Whittaker. Neither are Fran or Robin are able to be here today. So my name is Sean Winter and I'm the head of Pilgrim Theological College. And it's my great pleasure to be able to host this episode of By the Well for the 17th Sunday after Pentecost. We're going to be looking once again at some texts from Proverbs and then from James and then from the Gospel of Mark. And joining me in that conversation today is the Reverend Dr. Sally Douglas. Sally's the minister at Richmond Uniting Church. She teaches here at Pilgrim Theological College, is an honorary researcher at the University of Divinity. And Sally has been on the podcast before.
I have.
So welcome, Sally. Good to see you here. And I should probably say right at the beginning that Sally's the author of a forthcoming book that's about to be launched, actually the day after we recorded this podcast, called The Church as Salt, Becoming the Community Jesus Speaks About, published by Coventry Press. So Sally, congratulations on the book, but also welcome to By the Well. And I'm looking forward to this conversation that we're going to have around these texts from Proverbs and then James and then the Gospel of Mark.
Well, thanks, Sean. It's good to be here and to dive into these texts together.
That's great. Thank you. Let's begin again with Proverbs. We're still in Proverbs and in the wisdom literature, but we've kind of jumped ahead and we've come to Proverbs chapter 31 and to something that in my Bible is entitled An Ode to a Capable Wife. This is an interesting passage and probably has been used in all sorts of deeply suspicious and problematic ways in the history of interpretation. But it raises the question of how this language that we have in Proverbs around wisdom and what it means to live a wise life and how we go about conforming our lives to God's intentions for creation and for humanity and for human living, how this kind of works out on the ground. And here it's at the level of, this is what a wife should look like, at least on the surface of the text, that seems to be what it is. So it's kind of highly gendered, probably emerges to some degree out of a society that was pretty patriarchal. What kind of qualities does the text talk about, first of all, and then what do we do with the gender aspects of it from your perspective?
Good questions. And there's also even bigger debates about what is going on in this text. So you may have already discussed this with Fran, but in Proverbs, a central figure is this figure, woman wisdom, Sophia, and she is imaged as being alongside God and with God in creation, delighting in humanity, and God delights in her. If people want to go back and have a look at Proverbs 8 and 9, for example, and she calls everyone to a great feast. She features in the very first chapter of Proverbs, and some scholars would argue that here she's entirely domesticated. This amazing woman who is part of creation and in the act of creation is now sent back to the kitchen, right, and is seen as this hardworking woman who gets up before everyone, is carrying the mental load, which is a big conversation in our culture right now, and is doing all of the work, all of the thinking and planning, and it's just disastrous. So the values of working hard, looking after everybody, staying up later, getting up earlier. So it becomes deeply problematic in a culture where we're seeking to address some of this inequality and the misuse of women and their labour. But there's other really exciting stuff within this text that I'd like to invite us into just for a moment.
Can I just pause you at that point? Yes. So just to make clear, what you're suggesting is that personification of wisdom in the earlier part of Proverbs, that's actually strongly connected to this, yes, personification of a female character within, yes, the story itself.
So I don't think we could, because she's so central in Proverbs, I think it would be crazy to close our eyes and not assume that she's somehow part of this text as, okay, well, that it's not just some add-on. So as I said, some scholars just think, well, here she gets domesticated, like, you know, make the grand woman back in the kitchen.
So this isn't a manual of housekeeping or to go,
no,
how to keep your man happy kind of conversation.
Don't think so.
Right.
Now, this is what I think is even more convincing here. There's a couple of scholars, and in my first book I talk about it, so you can go and check the footnotes if you're listening to this thinking this what I'm about to say is absurd, because it may blow your mind. There are some scholars who argue that actually the language here, where she's described girding herself with strength and making her arm strong, is actually very close to resemblances of God, for example in Isaiah 52, and Ezekiel 4, so that there's some kind of God imagery going on with this woman who's in charge of everything. And interestingly, another scholar, I really love this because he presents it, but then he holds back. Al Walters talks about the valiant woman, quote, is celebrated in a literary form otherwise reserved for praise of Yahweh. Right. He doesn't then go on to say, huh, maybe this is Yahweh. He doesn't go that far, whether he thinks that it doesn't say it or he doesn't even occur to him. But I think there's a really strong case for suggesting that this is actually an imagery of God. She is the God who gets up early, cares for the needy, makes sure everyone has provision, and that flips the whole text on its head. It's not a domestication of woman wisdom. It's actually a celebration of God, she who is ordering the household well and cares for all.
So that would work, right? So the idea would be that the characteristics that we see, so you referred to verse 17 about the notion of strength. This is language, yes, that is used of Israel's God in other contexts.
Yeah.
The genre of this passage, I called it an ode to a capable wife, but another word for an ode is a hymn.
Yeah,
right?
It's a hymn.
So it's a hymn. It's a kind of celebration of this character. This would suggest that what's going on here is not simply a mundane, gender-specific description of domestic arrangements.
Exactly.
It actually is constantly pointing to this question of how wisdom is embodied in human lives in different kinds of ways.
That's right. And there's a big debate in circles that focus on these texts, like why would this female divine figure, woman wisdom, be in texts like Proverbs, very explicitly in Proverbs 8 and 9 and earlier as well. And one, there's all kinds of arguments, but the one that I find the most intriguing or potentially most convincing is that contextually the people of Israel have been in exile. So king imagery is pretty painful. It's abstract as well. We don't have our king. We don't have our land. But actually, so worship's turning back into the home when you're in exile or when the throne is no longer there. And so other imagery may have become far more important. And so imagery of the home and of the woman, the wise woman, as imagery for God makes much more sense when you are refugees or in exile and so on. And so this, I think, again, could be part of that imagery and this assurance that she is the one who will keep work. She's working hard and she cares not just for you in the household but the servants and also the needy beyond. Like it's so
drawn. She's caring for the poor. That's one of the things, looks after
that's
the
right.
needy. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then I noticed there's this interesting contrast in verse 23. You know, her husband's away kind of doing business at the city gates with the elders and everything else. But then she's the one in verse 26. She's the one who opens her mouth with wisdom. She's the one who teaches with kindness. So if you want to know where wisdom and kindness are found, you don't look at the city gate where the guys are hanging out. You actually go back to the kitchen to her.
Which is fascinating because at the very beginning of Proverbs, when wisdom's calling out at the city gate and then throughout the text, and then says, come to me, all who you foolish, you're wanting to learn, come to me. And then in chapter 9 of Proverbs, she sets the feast, like come into the house. And now we conclude with, I'm here at the heart of things and I have the wisdom for you and the nourishment for you.
Yeah, good. One of the things that we've explored over the past couple of weeks is this idea that while wisdom traditions and wisdom literature, kind of on the surface of it, are very clearly about, you know, how to live and what to do, ethics, if you like, there's always this sense that they're reaching beyond those questions to point towards, you know, who is God?
Yes.
How is God in relationship with the world? What is God's nature and how do our mundane embodied lives kind of reflect the character of God in certain ways, and what you just said seems to suggest that's something of what may be going on even here when you know we might think otherwise.
Absolutely. And I think and that speaks, you know, obviously to questions of Christology and some texts, like I know we're going to come to James, there's sense some I think sometimes unfairly it's judged as you know, moralism or, you know, liberal, but it's much more, I think, to do with if we take seriously that in Jesus, God comes to us somehow, we glimpse divine reality or we sense the story of God in person, then who and how Jesus embodies power reflects who and how God embodies power. So to imitate Jesus or to become like Jesus is to become aligned with the character of the universe.
Yeah, good. Well, talk about Jesus takes us, I think, clearly into the New Testament. Let's move on to talk about the passage from James, James 3, 13 to 4, 3, and then for various reasons there's a jump over to verse 7 and 8. I mean, clearly, again, a text that talks about wisdom and gentleness and the way in which that wisdom issues in certain kind of characteristics or values in human life and in human relationships. You wanted to say just a few words about to address this issue about authorship in James.
Why don't
you just talk to us about that for a moment?
Okay, so this is really exciting. Scholars are divided, of course, but it's not an insignificant number of scholars who would argue that it is possible that the author of James is James, the brother of Jesus, or that James is speaking and it's transcribed. So just to orient ourselves, this is where I love that it's kind of paired with Mark, because if we want a kind of honest version of what's happening with the disciples, Mark, I reckon, is our go-to often. So we already know in Mark 3 that Jesus' family, his mum and brothers, are freaking out and they say, "Would you just come home? Like, everyone thinks you've gone out of your mind. We're pretty embarrassed. Maybe we're a bit worried too. Like, seriously, come home." Now, it doesn't say James there, but it says Jesus' mum and brothers. And then in Mark 6, we get names of them, including James. So we know of this historical figure. So if there's some truth in Mark's gospel that everyone wasn't always going, "Everything is awesome, we love you, Jesus," and I think Mark is probably to be trusted here, that there was actual fighting and struggles and stress, we know that much about James, or at least his siblings and mum. Then we get this clue in Paul, in 1 Corinthians 15, that actually the risen Jesus appears to James. Like, it actually says the brother of Jesus. Now, if this is based in memory and truth, can you imagine the kind of journey this guy James has had from going, "Seriously, your embarrassment, come home," to knowing that your brother's been killed by the empire in the most agonizing and embarrassing of ways, like the most shameful death, to then having this brother turn up with the wounds? Oh my word.
I think it's really interesting. I mean, this thing that we all need to do to some extent, particularly I think if we're preaching from these texts, which is to imaginatively enter our way into what we can say about the experiences that lie behind the kind of, you know, quite sophisticated arguments and structure of a letter like James.
And
do that, reconstruct that from the fragments that we have. Of course, James, that same James comes into deep conflict with Paul.
I was about to say that. And, so we know he's a leader of the church, but they're at real odds about what it means to be a follower.
And James chapter 2, of course, seems to quite clearly allude to Paul's teaching about justification by
faith.
And in my view, pretty clearly directs a pretty strong polemic against it. Faith without works is dead.
I'm sure you've already covered this. I think it's more about James's longing for integration. Like, if this goes back to James, or someone who spent some time with Jesus in ministering, he knows that Jesus doesn't go around just saying, "Feed the poor, care for people." He keeps doing it. Like, Jesus is so integrated, like, turn the other cheek than he does to even death. There's this radical integration of the call to compassion and the living it out. And I think the author of James is incredibly impacted by that and can't believe that now the community's gathering and they're favouring the ones with nicer clothes and they're not actually caring for the poor. You know, like, it's driving this author insane. So I don't know. I reckon if James and Paul sat down now and went, "What did you really mean?" I reckon they'd probably be more on the same page than maybe it can be presented as. And again, so that call then in James to the wisdom that came down. I didn't write about this in my first book when I was talking about wisdom Christology, because I was really clear about wanting to say with texts which were quite explicit or pretty clearly reflecting wisdom Christology, understandings of Jesus as woman wisdom, this Proverbs figure, which happens in other texts like Colossians and in Matthew and so on and John's Gospel. But coming back to these texts again, I can't help but think that it's here as well. Like, it's the wisdom that came down, and then the description of being gentle and so on is like a description of what Jesus is like in living and dying and rising.
So verse 17, "The wisdom from above is pure, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield." There's some incredibly rich language in the Greek there. And I think you're right, without a trace of partiality. That's what we saw in the reading from a couple of weeks ago. So you're suggesting that even though, again, that looks like it's kind of moralistic values type language, actually there's the potential for a kind of Christological undercurrent to rooted in a wisdom Christology.
And so becoming like that is to become like Jesus, who is the God one. Like, it's profoundly Christological. It's really astonishing.
Let's come on then to the other side of things then. So if that's what you are trying to cultivate, this kind of Christologically inspired form of behavior that's peaceable, gentle, et cetera, et cetera.
Which is radically disruptive to patriarchy.
Well, exactly. So what's the other side? What is it that you're resisting? There's this strong language about conflicts, dispute, enmity.
Envy as well. It's so interesting. And I feel like we have not taken this seriously enough in our Christian, like the whole Christian tradition, I mean, that so for these wisdom texts, so often envy is the root of disruption. And so even if you think of in Galatians, that list of the gifts of the Spirit and the spirit of flesh, that sense of envy and conflict being really the core things that disrupt the community. And in the Wisdom of Solomon, there's this kind of parable just in chapters 1 and 2, and then this language about through the devil, envy comes and brings death. Like there's this really strong, and I can't help but think that somehow James is reflecting or drawing from some of this idea, that notion that when we are not actually aligned, knowing that we are beloved of God, that's when we're going to compare and contrast and be envious. Like when we're not sure who we are or if we're in or whatever, that's the envy, that's the whole conflict and everything else.
I mean, just to focus down on the detail, the Greek there is really interesting in that the translation bitter envy, the word for envy is actually zelos, which means zeal or jealousy. It can be quite a neutral or even a positive word.
Like, yep, zeal for the Lord.
Then it becomes picros, it becomes bitter. Mm. So it's this idea that an ordinary human inclination that can be so constructive and productive and positive in the way that we think about it, that can be distorted and deformed in such a way that it becomes profoundly problematic within human relationships and, of course, within the Christian community.
Yeah, and I think it's so profound because it's so much easier, and Christians and churches do this all the time, to focus on things that seem like more kind of movie quality big sin, you know, rather than actually how did you just speak about that person? Right. Whether it was on Twitter or face-to-face, how did you actually – that person left the room and what did you all do there? That's like, right. And that's the corrosive element that this – so the choice to be gentle is really courageous and really hard work. The choice to be always kind is really hard yards, and that's the call.
Yeah, verse 18 has this on the positive side of the equation, it has this lovely phrase that the harvest of righteousness, the kind of fullness of righteousness is sown – by those who make peace. So the little acts of peacemaking that you contribute actually generate and build towards some kind of overall harvest of righteousness within the life of a community. And I guess the opposite is also case. So small acts
Correct.
Of envy, conflict, dissent.
Little snide comments
that together build up towards. And I like the way that James is so clear that Christian virtue is not simply about an awareness of what it is that God wants and trying to do it. Mm. It's also a very clear-eyed awareness of what the alternatives to that are within a community
and
naming them and being prepared to call them out and resist them when necessary.
Exactly. I love Bonhoeffer in his book around the community life together has this commitment, which I try and fail, but I really try and live by, about not saying anything about any of the others in the community unless you'd be happy to say it in front of them. And it's just a great way of just checking in with what's going on with your internal dialogue, but also whether you're slipping into the envy and so on. The other thing, just before we move on to Mark, is it's interesting. It's got this draw near to God and don't, you know, flee from the devil and so on. So in David Bentley Hart, he translates it as slanderer, which is for the devil, which I think is helpful too, that notion of the toxicity of lies, like the destructive nature of slandering either ourselves or other people, and how that can possess us, really. So whether people want to think I think we need to think seriously about the devil, whether we take it literally or metaphorically, I don't really mind. But the notion that this kind of energy of being cynical or rude about others is a bit addictive, and it can become possessive. So noticing that when we draw near to God, who is the peaceable one and the gentle one and the merciful one, to be shaped by that rather than the other direction, as you said.
And we saw last week that the tongue and what we say and the way that we speak becomes a kind of window into all of those relational and spiritual dynamics that are at work in human relationships and in Christian communities.
Exactly.
No, that's good. Well, this text, and I think James as a whole, strikes me as a good window through which to look at some of the our experiences of community and human relationships, and use this text as a way of being honest and clear-eyed about the alternative ways of basing the pattern of our lives. Mm. We'll come back in a moment and we'll talk about the Gospel of Mark.
Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find a link at our website, bythewell.com.au.
So we now come to Mark's Gospel, Mark chapter 9, and we are on the way down from the Mountain of Transfiguration and arriving at Capernaum, back at the scene of Jesus' earlier Galilean ministry. But some important things have happened in chapter 8 and 9, as we've explored in the last couple of weeks of By the Well. Sally, set the scene for this particular episode and the teaching that is contained within it.
Sure. So I love Mark's Gospel so badly. And I think it really helps to see the humour and hear it if you read it out loud or read it with someone else. So here is one another of those humorous, even though it's intense and painful, often like the way that comedy works, it, you know, goes to a really hard truth, but through humour. So Jesus is trying to tell them, yes, I'm the Messiah, but actually I'm going to get killed. And Peter freaks out, as we already know. And then they've had this mountaintop experience and they're like, woohoo, even though they're terrified. But Jesus comes back to, this way, is it going to be suffering and humiliation? And basically, I think you can imagine the disciples around Jesus with their fingers in their ears going, la, 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 not listening, not listening. And then they're fighting on the road. They're completely blocked out what Jesus said. They're arguing about who's the most important, which is the absolute opposite of what Jesus is repeatedly trying to tell them. They get to the house. So much of what happens in Mark's Gospels is in a domestic setting. It's in the house, which I think is something we really need to celebrate and come back to. But he's like, what are you talking about? What were you talking about? And you can just all imagine like looking at their feet going, oh, my word. Oh my
word. I like that contrast between the kind of what were you arguing about on the way?
Yeah.
So the way is the way of discipleship, and the house, which is the kind of location for instruction in the Gospel of Mark in so many places, is the place where you kind of stop in that journey of discipleship and ask, or in this case are asked by God or by Jesus, so what's going on here? What do you think you're up to? I think it's a really striking kind of spatial and visual image for what happens when discipleship communities gather together and pause and ask themselves on a regular basis, what are we doing?
What are we here for?
Have we understood this correctly and are instructed along the way? So the message is the message again of suffering.
Yeah.
And it's contained within that kind of passion prediction in verses 30 to 31. It's the second of the three Mark and passion predictions in Mark 8, 9, and 10. But Jesus seems to move beyond just talking about himself. He extends it out then to questions about how the disciples themselves are to behave. So what happens? How does that connection get made?
So this is amazing that Jesus is such an honest leader. Rather than saying, follow me and you'll get all the good stuff, it, you know, becomes really clear that this is going to be this costly way. So if we think about the common era and the patriarchal context that we're in at this point, children are pretty low in terms of the valuing in society. It doesn't mean that parents didn't love their children. Of course they did. But in terms of who's important and who's not, children are not seen as important. And you see that kind of imagery and understanding in Paul, for example. It's like, don't be like a child, an annoying child. I have to give you milk because you're not ready for solid food, in 1 Corinthians and so on. Interestingly different from 1 Peter, but that's another story. So there's this common view in philosophy at the time and that's influencing others like Paul and everywhere basically that if you are being like a child, then you are not being you're not behaving in ways that are to be esteemed, and the goal is to be beyond that. So Jesus in Mark, it's really interesting, has two different conversations about becoming like a child and in this case it's not becoming like a child. And I think it's really important that we separate them, like hold them both as really important, both really disruptive but different. So here it's not the passage about become like a child. Instead, Jesus makes this astonishing, astonishing claim about his own divinity. He's a child in the household, so we don't know whose child it is. Could be Peter's, could be whoever it is, and enfolds this child in his arms. So brings the child who's on the edges of importance into the very centre, and then says, if you welcome this child, you welcome me. And then says, and if you welcome me, you welcome the one who sent me. So this is saying this is where God is. Mm. It's an incredible reversal of understandings of power and importance here.
So the and it therefore becomes an illustration of the basic principle in verse 35, whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all. And the child is brought into the midst as an illustration of, well, you know, this person belongs at the lower end of whatever social hierarchy we operate in within our culture and within a household, and I'm actually going to place them at the center of the community of discipleship as a way of challenging your ridiculous preoccupation in the light of what I've told you, your ridiculous preoccupation with the question of, you know, who's going to be the greatest and who's going to kind of come out on top.
Exactly. And it's saying, it's not just saying reverse the power, but saying this is actually how the power is.
Yeah.
You guys just don't get it.
Yeah, no, that's right.
So it's a really profound, like, to take that seriously in our congregations and our planning for worship and every, like, to really wrestle with that. There's some beautiful stuff that Chris Barnett is doing, intergenerational, like helping people to think more about worship and faith communities as intergenerational communities where the voices of the 90-year-old and the 5-year-old are equally heard.
Yeah.
And there's something to me that's that sits really well with that understanding, with this kind of gospel proclamation.
Yeah. I am Mark is full of all sorts of kind of delicious ironies.
Yes.
And one of the ones I picked up was the way in which in the Passion prediction in verse 31, we have this phrase, the Son of Man is to be betrayed into human hands, which is betrayal into hands that will commit violence against the Son of Man, contrasted then with the child being taken into the arms of Jesus. As the embodiment, I think, of that kind of gentleness that you were describing in terms of a wisdom Christology.
Exactly.
Perhaps.
This is the one who holds and honours and does not hurt or harm. This is the disclosure of who and how God is, and it is good news. Yeah,
Sally, thanks ever so much for that. It's been great talking to you, and I've enjoyed very much working through Proverbs, James, and the Gospel of Mark with you. Remember that Sally's book, The Church of Salt, Becoming the Community Jesus Speaks About, is being launched tomorrow and is available from Coventry Press. Thanks for listening to By the Well.
Thanks, Sean.
By the Well has been recorded on Wurundjeri land. It's produced by Adrian Jackson and brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia.